If you're enjoying this independent podcast, I'd really appreciate it if you could take a few moments to do a review, like, share and subscribe. And if you'd like to see extra content and show your support, head to the Patreon. The link is in the show notes. Narcissists are like a different species, according to Sam Vaknin. They cannot have real friends. They're incapable of love. But they are capable of mimicking emotions and being a chameleon in different situations. Earlier in the filming process with Mark Vicenti, he boasted he could even cry for them.
People felt it. People felt it for millennia. They felt that there was an alien species among them. Look, I look like a human being. I talk like a human being. I make some of you smile sometimes, so I can reach into you and I can push the right buttons. You want me to? I'll even imitate empathy. I'll even cry if you want. But I am not you, and I am not like you.
In the final interview, months later, Mark wanted to push on Sam's claim that he was not human and asked if he'd ever tried to be. Immediately before this question, Sam had just said he'd envied people who could laugh, who could cry, feel normal emotions.
You speak as though it's fait accompli, in absolutes, about your qualia of existence, or the lack of qualia of existence. And a part of me sits here and goes, I don't know, have you tried? I understand the stupidity of this question. You know where I'm heading, Sam? Like, a part of me goes like, okay, listen, here you go being so special with your bottomless pit. Have you tried? Or am I so misunderstanding your condition? Because when you speak, it sounds like you have meta-awareness of self.
I'm a trained observer. I'm a trained observer as a physicist, as a psychologist. I'm trained to observe. And I observe myself in as detached and scientific a way as I can. I'm lucky to not have access to emotions, probably, because if I had access to emotions, I would have committed suicide, undoubtedly. So I'm an observer. Your question is self-defeating. I'll try to explain to you why. When I tell you, listen, try to operate this camera, you would ask me how. And I would have an algorithm for you. I have a user manual. I'd have this guy explain to you how to operate the camera. When I tell you, try to not be depressed, which I do with my clients, I have an algorithm for them. I have solutions, tried and true. I have medication. I can't prescribe medication, but I can ask one of my colleagues to prescribe medication. So there are ways and means. My problem is that I don't exist. Can you tell me how to exist? Is there an algorithm as to how to exist? Is there a user manual? Can someone teach me how to exist? I can teach you how to operate a camera. Can you teach me how to exist? Of course not. There's no way around this fundamental problem. By the way, it's not me. It's not about being special. The person who first came with these insights, his name is Otto Kernberg. Otto Kernberg was the great-great-grandfather of modern Cluster B personality disorder studies. He was the foremost scholar of borderline and narcissistic disorders. And he's the one who said that at the core of narcissism and borderline, there is an emptiness. He coined the word emptiness. There is an emptiness, and he said, they could never fulfill this emptiness because they are not. It's Kernberg, it's not Sam Vaknin. And it's not about being special. It doesn't make me feel special at all. It's the only point where possibly I feel inferior. I told you, I would give my right hand, probably my left hand also, if I could, I don't know, court a girl for 1 hour. How does that make me superior?
He's bending down to get his water bottle, takes a sip, and puts a hand up to his eyes, pushing his glasses up, and appears to be crying. His fingers drop to below his mouth, his chin is quivering. His hand lingers to the side of his mouth, his head bowed.
I'm sorry.
Oh, please, it's fine.
He stands up and walks away from the camera. Mark cleverly says nothing. Sam eventually returns to the chair.
So, I'm very angry.
Right.
I'm very angry at not having ever existed, because I think I had many gifts. They were taken away from me when I was essentially helpless as a child. Yeah. I couldn't defend myself.
He's fiddling with his hair now, exactly how the others described.
That's how superior I feel. I hope I answered your question.
He takes his glasses off and rubs his eyes.
Sam, it seems that we share grief, though, no? We share grief. Don't we?
I suggested in my last videos that narcissism is an element of prolonged grief. Of course, a narcissist is grieving, mourns himself, mourns what he could have been. Even the most overt Donald Trump narcissist has moments alone in the toilet, probably, where he realizes that he doesn't exist. And that no amount of honors and money and beautiful models and pleasures can cover up for this yawning gap, this corridor with howling winds that passes for himself. And it's a very, very... It's knowing at the core. It's a feeling of constant annihilation, extermination, self-extermination. People demonize narcissists, and I contributed my share. I think actually I started the whole thing because of my self-hatred and self-loathing. I was the first to place texts online in 1995 that kind of demonized the narcissist. But it's not fun to be a narcissist. It's not fun at all. Not that I'm asking for sympathy or pity, because I don't deserve any. I really don't deserve any, and no narcissist deserves pity or sympathy or empathy. But it's not easy to be one. And perhaps the abuse that narcissists heap on other people is their attempt to share the grief or to share the misery, because misery loves company. And so, you know, I'm miserable. I want you to be miserable. Then we can be miserable. We can commiserate, you know. That's possibly one of the explanations of the abuse. But there is no way. There's no way for me to communicate what it is to be me. And trust me, I'm about to deliver a grandiose statement. If I can't communicate what it is to be a narcissist, no one can. For sure. I have a complete mastery of the English language, you may have noticed. And if I fail to find words, then there are no words. And there are no words because language reflects the commonality of human experience. And there is no commonality here. We have nothing in common. Nothing. We are different species, definitely.
This was the moment you heard Mark talk about at the beginning of the series. I'll remind you of what he said.
I think what happened is that intellectually I sort of checkmated him, and there was no way to go intellectually, so he resorted to some very childlike behavior. And he has this complete meltdown on camera, which I wasn't sure what I was watching. It's like, you know, when you watch something happen, like a building fall over or something, and you'd watch it like you're frozen just watching the thing. It's almost like it's not real. And I couldn't tell, like, is this real? Like, is he really crying? And I wasn't sure, because when the evening was done and it was too dark to continue shooting and we're like, that's it, he suddenly switched into, did you bring the wine? You know, because Scott, did he bring wine? He's, yes. So he wanted to start drinking. And I said, but you have diabetes. He goes, ah, it's fine. You know, I was like, that's interesting. Then we went back to the hotel and he was hitting on, you know, some woman in the hotel. So that once he left, I went outside to this bar. All the crew was sitting there. And I said, guys, before we continue, just let me ask you, did you guys buy any of that? And they all said, no, we didn't. I was like, huh, that's interesting. So I think for me, partially, some of the sort of empathy pulled a bit. And when they say they didn't buy it, and then we began reflecting back on, yeah, I think it was just a ploy. Like, maybe he really did have a suffering moment, and maybe he really was feeling sorry for himself. But he's constantly playing with people and toying with people. It's a bit like, you know, children at a certain age, they try every single thing they can to get out of something or get what they want. And that's what I began to realize. I began to realize that what I was dealing with was a toddler in a man's body, but still had toddler impulses.
It's hard to not feel sorry for someone crying when they're talking about their missed potentials in life, especially against a background of abuse. But his victims and Richard all believe they're crocodile tears, just another manipulation. And Richard even offers a more chilling explanation for that specific crying incident, which made it into the cut of the documentary.
The crying, I now know, is not real. I know that he has a specific routine and words that he uses with the women, because I've been in the chat group with them where they'll share screenshots of him crying on Zoom calls and exactly what he says. And that little monologue from the documentary is exactly what he says. The button he pushes in women is, I'm a lost little boy and you can save me. That monologue that he's doing in the documentary is an advert for future victims, nothing else. It's to make, he knows that other women in the future will watch that and they will come to him to save him. It's like a predator sending out a scent that draws prey. There's no sincerity there whatsoever. He does the same monologue every time. If he didn't think it would be overly theatrical, what he would do, what he does in person, and he's done with me, is he twists his hair as though he's in distress and rocks and cries. It's an act. It's an act. He is a pure predator. I know it's wrong. You know, I watch somebody crying there and I laugh and I make a wry smile, but I know what he's doing now. I know 100% what he's doing now. There is no sincerity there whatsoever. That is an act to draw more prey in.
We know Sam boasted about being in the documentary as a tool to silence his victims. It seems he was also hoping it would be a platform to hunt for even more. It was at the end of 2022 that the documentary team and Richard learned of Sam's violations against women, and they captured Richard's shock of not only what Sam had done to his victims, but that he'd been planning on bringing him down too, right from the beginning of their working relationship years earlier.
One of the things that I have to accept about this situation is that I thought I knew who and what Sam Vaknin was, and I clearly didn't have a fucking clue. And I'm learning that the hard way. The only people who have that can offer me insight into Sam Vaknin's real nature are his victims. And when I ask them and they collate the information that they have and what he said about me to them, he's loathed me from the beginning. He's hated me from the beginning. I really don't take that personally. It was a business decision to work with him. I knew he was mentally ill. I knew he was a psychopath, a borderline, and a narcissist. I knew these things, and I knew it was going to be a rough ride, but I thought it would be worth it. So I invested time, attention, and money to help him. I went above and beyond. I was very, very patient with him. He's done wildly offensive things to me multiple times over the years that I permitted, that I said, okay, you know, I'll just take that as part of the package deal. To find that he actually loathed me from day one is disorientating. And I think one of the frightening things about it is that I didn't see it. I had no idea that the entire time he was talking to me and friending me up, inside of his head, he was thinking, fuck you, die, 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 I hate you. That's scary. That's a really creepy thought.
The waking up phase for victims can start with a slap in the face when they witness the horror of the mask drop. But it takes time for the full impact, the history to be reassessed before they see what's happened to them. Richard couldn't help but draw comparisons with Mark Vicente's journey of surviving the Nexium cult.
Something of an irony to me that you, having made a documentary about cults, then choose to do a documentary about narcissism. And from the moment I first worked with you in Prague and with Sam in Prague, everything after that started to fall apart. And that's a year ago that we all worked together last February, I've realized that I've been in a cult. And I know I've been in a cult, and I know that I've been brainwashed, because when I'm speaking to Sam's exes and his victims, they use turns of phrase like Sam does. They even respond emotionally like Sam does. And then I reply back with his same terms of phrase. We're using the same pacing and phraseology that Sam does. I haven't told them yet. I will, but they're very emotionally dysregulated, especially with what's going on now. And they won't take it well, but it's true. We're infected, and we are mini Sams. We're all mini Sams. When I first published the first edition of my book, one of the criticisms that I know that I'm somewhat brainwashed into a cult is that I was using too many adjectives to describe the same thing. So if I said that something was, it was a sad day, I would say it was sad, it was maudlin, depressing, unhappy, you know, and on, with multiple adjectives to describe one thing. That's not my writing style, that's Sam's writing style. He wants to show that he's like a human thesaurus and he knows all the synonyms for one word. I don't need to do that. I've never done. It was a weird thing, the editor pulled it out. I said, why do you do this in your writing? It doesn't help at all. It's quite boring. You have like a lecturing, hectoring style. It's quite irritating. And I was like, I'm sorry, I don't know. It's Sam. I've picked up his modes of thinking. When I see other people defending Sam, I can hear myself defending Sam. Yes, he's mentally ill. He openly admits it. As though the frank admission that you're mentally ill and abusive is a sort of armor to being mentally ill and abusive. It isn't. He's openly admitting that he's mentally ill and abusive, and therefore, what? He has carte blanche to do and say whatever he wants? That's insane. That doesn't make any sense. They're using the same argumentation that I've been using. When you're in it, you think, yes, he's sick, but he's sick to hear this high and no further. And based on what I found out, he's sick in ways. He's not only sick in ways I didn't know he could be, he's sick in ways I didn't know a human being could be. I'm no dummy. I've been around. I work for the the probation service here in the UK, the Crown Prosecution Service, I've seen real criminals at work. This is something beyond. Of all the people, all the stories I've ever heard over the years, violent assaults, PTSD, complex post-traumatic stress, childhood abuse, I've never seen anything like this. It kind of puts me into a state of shock. I start to dissociate because I can't fathom what it is that I don't understand about this. It's a cult, and I've been brainwashed, and he is the cult leader, and I have been his, I've been a cult member. I thought it was just me, but I've given him access to other people. I've given him validity. I've given him a platform and a name that meant that vulnerable men and women would go to him and ask him for therapy, and I've assisted in that. It wasn't just about me, because I thought, I can take it. I'll be all right, which I was, like I have been, but it's not just about me. It was stupid and naive to think that he wouldn't use this to predate upon people. I had no idea. In the last five years, he's been with 30 women, 30 different women behind his wife's back. It's a pretty high number. He's been a busy boy. I had no idea. If you'd asked me, I knew of five. 30. 30 in 5 years. That's a lot. It's a lot. I just didn't know.
You heard in the last episode about the grooming of Richard, the on-ramp for him, and the pushing of boundaries. What you don't know is that his own working relationship with Sam had come to an end just about the time that the victims came forward, but for a very different reason.
So what actually happened took place in Zurich in December, but what preceded it were issues that we had in Bucharest in August. So I was already very angry with Sam because of things that he'd done in Bucharest in the August. By the time I went to Zurich in December, when I arrived there, and actually he wanted me to be involved in some project, and when I met the people involved in the project, I realized the whole thing was a sham. I had agreed to go there, I had agreed to interview him again, I'd agreed to help him with this project that he was working on, and just like Bucharest, I did it as a favor for him. I don't need Sam Vaknin. My business doesn't need Sam Vaknin. He's not part of my business model. It's a favor to somebody who I respect and I like and I listen to the opinions of. And I got there and I realized that he had used me and that the whole project that he was getting me involved in was nothing. And I knew that he knew it was nothing. So I was very angry. He'd been, in the 5 days before I went there, he was talking about a girl that he wanted me and him to have a threesome with. Well, I don't do that. And I don't want to see Sam Vaknin naked. And so I was trying to politely laugh it off and say, Sam, no, you know, you keep her for yourself, haha. I got there and I met this girl on the Saturday night and I met his business partners and I realized that the whole thing was nonsense. And that night, I dropped them off in a taxi, and then I took the taxi went on to my own hotel. He was texting me and saying, this girl really likes you. She wants to meet you. Me and her are over, and she wants to meet you without me. Can I please give her your number? I said, yes, yeah, sure. Go ahead. Knowing full well that the correct answer to that question was no. Don't give her my number. I don't want to talk to her. The end. I was pissed off. I said, yeah, give her my number. He, at the same time, pushed her to message me. He said to her, don't waste any time. Richard's a borderline, which means he's going to forget what you look like inside of 48 hours. So make sure you message him straight away. Get out of my hotel room. I never want to see you again. I have another girl coming today. He had another one of his women arriving that day, which he did. I met her the next day. So this girl and I, we met in a Starbucks, and I wanted to know what had happened. As far as I knew, she'd only known Sam for 5 days, because that's all I'd heard of, was the 5 days. I'd only heard her name from 5 days before. And we ended up talking for 9 hours. She'd been brainwashed by Sam. She was very confused. She felt very, very guilty. She felt like she was to blame for all the abuse he'd heaped on her. She basically described a scenario that sounded like he tried to get her to kill herself. He'd used interrogation techniques on her, sleep deprivation and brainwashing. He admitted to me the next day that he had tried to get her to kill herself. And I spent, as I say, 9 hours talking to her. And we didn't spend the entire time at Starbucks. At a certain point, we went to my hotel room and, well, what happened between me and her inside of the hotel room is nobody's business. It was between me and her. And then I awoke the next day to furious texts from Sam, who was beside himself with rage. I thought, what's the problem? He's pushed me, he's pushed her, he's given us both all of the reasons why everything is fine and we can do whatever we want and we're both free agents. I shouldn't have done it. Not because it's morally wrong, but because professionally it's messy. I should have just said no, so that I could just leave Zurich and just wipe my hands of the whole thing and say, Sam, you go your way, I'll go mine. I shouldn't have let it play out that way. It was passive aggressive. But in a way, now looking back, knowing what I now know because of it, I don't regret it. And he was really furious. He was really, really furious that I had done what he had asked me repeatedly over and over again to do. I hadn't actually done what he'd asked me to do. These are his wild, cuckold fantasies, but I shouldn't have even been in a hotel room with her, where the possibility of us doing something could happen. If I wanted to maintain a relationship with him, I shouldn't have even been in that position because I know he's obsessed with masochism and cuckoldry. But I was sick of being a good little bitch. And I said, okay.
This was an extremely shortened version of what happened. I heard the very long version from Richard. This victim, we'll call Jane, had been sent by Sam on a mission to seduce Richard. He attributes no blame on her. He accepted he was done with Sam, he was angry, and not in a good headspace in his personal life following a breakup. They did not have full sexual intercourse. They did, however, have sexual contact. Looking back, Richard realises that Sam knew he was pulling out of working with him and needed collateral on him. And Richard fell into his trap because he had crossed a line with one of Sam's brainwashed and severely abused victims. He later found out Sam tried to get Jane to commit suicide at least 5 times and had threatened to reveal sensitive information to her family, which would put her at risk.
That story sounds like I'm throwing Jane under the bus, and I don't mean to, but at the end of the day, I didn't know what their relationship was. I didn't know the situation that she was in with her family. I didn't know how risky it was. And in my opinion, all I would say is, if I had been given proper information, I would not have consented. I would not have consented.
And Sam would have sent her on a mission to aggressively pursue you to seduce you.
I have the screenshots of him doing that. So this is what people need to understand. He accused me of sexual predatory behavior. Then he bizarrely accused her of it. And the reason I say I don't want to throw her under the bus is because she defended me to him for 2 months and kept me in the loop. He interrogated her for hours, sleep deprivation, dehydration, face to face. He wanted to know every single detail, and she told him. She told him. So at times, when he would switch into one mindset, he'd be like, Richard did this to you. He forced you. Then he would say, you disgusting slut. You coerced him. He thinks nothing of me. He calls me a spineless people pleaser. He said, you coerced a spineless people pleaser. No. There were 2 adults in that room of consenting age. Okay. Not all information was given. Not everything was made clear. But I want to make clear, there was no crime. I wasn't screaming, no, she wasn't. Nobody was predating. There was no crime there. Yes, in another message, when he switches into his adult mode, which he can do, he can be mature and he can be clear. He says to her, look,
I'm sorry. I set you up. I set and I made, I caused you to do this. It is all my fault. I'm sorry. So he has admitted. I don't know if you can coerce somebody to, well, apparently you can. He groomed her to do that. He needed that. He needed the betrayal. He needed from his best friend and his, what he keeps calling her his girlfriend. I'm like, what the fuck does that mean? To betray him. That was his, the finalization of his masochistic cuckold fantasy.
He talks about it in the interview with me in terms of, I'm sure he says something about when it comes down to them orchestrating it, if they believe that they are going to lose the person, they set up a scenario which makes it so in his fantasy, and this is not reality, in his fantasy he was in a relationship with this very beautiful young woman, and the reality was an extremely damaged, traumatized patient came to him for therapy. He sexually assaulted her. This is part of the therapy. This is a very, very damaged young woman being used as a puppet.
I have seen multiple emails and text messages from Sam to Jane and others boasting about how he orchestrated the interaction between Richard and Jane. So Richard's account and Jane's account are corroborated by Sam in writing, but also in an audio recording. The morning after Sam and Richard had to get a taxi together, there had already been abusive phone calls and messages from Sam, so Richard decided to record him, knowing this was the final straw and he would never work with him again. You'll hear that Richard appeases Sam in this painfully long conversation. He just wanted to get out of Switzerland and knew that arguing with Sam was pointless. It's a 40-minute recording, so I'll let you hear some small parts. Sam begins by explaining how he'd thrown the girl out. Remember, she was a patient, not his girlfriend.
I'm the one who offered to you.
Yeah.
I've done it 3 times, if I got it correctly.
Yeah.
I was extremely explicit. I gave you a number.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not about this.
Okay.
I threw her out of the apartment 3 times. I don't know if she told you. And,
no.
And she returned.
Okay.
So I was overwhelmingly relieved when she left.
Okay.
To tell you the truth. So it's not about this. And of course, I'm 62, so I realize it's going to be just a sex romp and
mm-hmm.
a sexual adventure, and nothing will come out. I didn't expect anything long term. And then I said, why not let you explore possibilities with her? I mean, why monopolize her in any way, shape or form? Mm. Even if I could, which I'm not sure I could, but why monopolize her?
Mm.
If I can, you know, make two people happy. Really, I'm this kind of guy, and there's no problem with it. Mm. Like, if she could make you happy, you could make her happy. Both of you have my blessing, especially you. You're my friend.
He tells Richard she would make a good partner for him. He seems calm. Further into this recording, you'll hear Sam telling off the taxi driver for eavesdropping.
Here's the issue. Here's what bothers me. And I gave you a number, but I thought you would have the sensitivity and good manners to not initiate the meeting while I'm still with her. While I'm still here on this trip, present. I don't think it was okay behavior.
Okay.
I think it was unboundaried. I think it was unfriendly.
Mm.
It was okay. I gave you a number, of course. I gave you a number for you to meet her.
Mm.
But bloody hell, it's my trip. She's still with me. Mm. In my bed, actually, when you were chatting with her. I think you could have waited. I think you could have met her maybe in another trip. Or I don't think the haste was seemly or appropriate, honestly.
Okay. Okay.
Even if she was just a sex partner, she is my sex partner.
Mm.
It's and she's here clearly on this trip with me.
Mm-hmm.
You saw her in the dinner.
Mm.
She's with me.
Mm-hmm.
I would appreciate if you don't listen.
Oh, no problem, sir. Sex is a big problem around the world.
Sex is a big problem, but your intrusion is inappropriate.
No problem, sir.
Thank you.
Discretion, it's banana.
Not discretion. You're looking at us while we are talking. That's not okay.
Why not?
Why not? Because it's none of your business. Your business is to drive.
I can't look into you, or what's the problem?
Not when I'm talking.
Why not?
Because you are listening. That's not okay. That's maybe in the KGB. Here is not okay.
What should I do, sir? Close my ears, or what?
Well, good idea.
It's not my problem, sir. It's your problem.
You can start with that.
Yeah.
So, the problem was not what you did, but I thought that as your friend, I deserved not to witness this happening. Imagine that you're with a girl, and you're with her for a week, you know? And then tell me, listen, I'm finished with her. You can have her if you're interested. And then that very night, I pick her up.
Mm.
How would you feel?
I don't know. I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't put myself in that situation. It's not my style at all.
That was my girl. That came to you.
Okay.
Went to you. With my blessing.
Mm.
But still, I think common courtesy would have required you for me not to be there anymore.
Yes.
To wait for me to be gone.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, that would have been much cleaner. It would have been better.
Not for me to witness this whole thing.
Yeah.
It's painful, even if it's a sex op.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially after what you witnessed in Liverpool.
He references the incident from Liverpool, which you heard about previously, when he first brought a woman along with him to filming, and Richard then cut his ties with Sam. Sam admits in this conversation in the taxi that he told the crew member he could fuck the discarded woman. But in this scenario also, he objected to the timing that he was still present.
The similarities are striking. I wouldn't say overwhelming, but striking. Even on the assumption that maybe we just had a tiff, maybe she and I just had a fight, you should have waited. Maybe it would have resolved.
You told me you had another woman coming. You said, be with her, I don't care about her, there's another woman coming.
No, I'm not referring to the fact that you ended up with her. That's perfectly okay. You behaved impeccably there.
Yeah.
No problem there. But the timing I'm talking.
Mm.
Even if I had another woman coming, maybe the tiff would have resolved itself, the fight would have resolved itself, and we would have agreed to meet a week later.
Richard gets out of the taxi briefly to collect something. He mumbles his true feelings about the conversation after exiting the car.
What a fucking lunatic.
When he gets back in the taxi, Sam is deeply unsatisfied that Richard's just been trying to appease him. Sam goes round and round in circles until Richard eventually tells him he's being masochistic and suspected it was nothing more than a loyalty test.
We have had this conversation before where...
But it hurt because of your behaviour, Richard. It didn't hurt because of her. I wanted her to be with you. I still think she could be good for you as a hint for the future. It's up to you. But
it's a little masochistic, Sam. It's a little masochistic.
But had you not behaved this way, there would have been no pain.
I doubt it, but I concede the point. I concede the point.
As I've already mentioned, Sam admits publicly about pushing women to sleep with other men. He even has a name for it, betrayal fantasy. Listen carefully to this next clip from his YouTube, where he directly references doing this to ex-partners and his wives. He's been married twice. His current marriage has lasted almost 30 years. It's hard to believe that Lydia is unaware of what he's been doing to other women.
I have a strange habit. Whenever I start a relationship with a woman, I push her to be with strangers, or even better, with my friends. I don't do it because I'm aroused by the idea of the woman in my life having sex with others. I'm not a cuckold. I do it because it causes me excruciating pain.
I recalled certain phrases and sentences that my intimate partners told me, my girlfriends, my wives, they told me, because I subjected all of them to this cycle successfully. The overwhelming vast majority of them ended up being with other men, sometimes as fast as 4 days or 6 days. I'm good at what I do. They succumbed to the betrayal fantasy. They fitted into it and they played the role to perfection. But in the process, and definitely in the aftermath, when they woke up from this simulation, from this dream state, and they realized what they had done, many of them became very ego dystonic. Even those who did not become ego dystonic realized that they had been played and manipulated into the role. So they spoke to me. As an example, one of them told me, "I thought you were getting rid of me. I thought you wanted me to sleep with another man." Another one told me, "I thought you hate me and you would be angry if I do not go to the other man. You love pain and you will do anything to be in pain. You push your woman to cheat to in order to be able to say that mommy again betrayed poor baby." Another one told me, "We agreed and you insisted that I try to have a baby with another man. You love pain. You push your women to cheat and then you're in pain." And Richard Grenon, my fake friend, told me, "Everyone is your puppet because you want to prove to yourself that every woman will betray you and is a whore, like your mother."
Richard having crossed this line with Jane meant Sam's mask could now drop. He could perform his discard. And later that day, he made a shocking admission.
And he said, "Richard, you have misunderstood me and misunderstood our friendship from the start." He said, "You think that when I say I want to kill women, that it's some sort of a joke or it's a shtick. It's not. I am like a serial killer. If I was braver and didn't fear blood, I would torture women to death and kill them with knives. If anybody wants me to write a witness statement to this or polygraph it or multiple polygraphs, I will do it. I have no problem doing it. So my intention with women has, you don't know me." He says, "You don't know me. You think I'm joking. I want these women to die because I can't kill them directly. I want them to commit suicide." And I'm looking at him. He goes into one of his personalities is Israeli Special Forces tough guy. He's like, "You don't know me. I can break your bones." He says, "If I choose to, I can break your bones. I'm trained in Haganah." I was like, "Yes, of course, my love. Of course you could. Of course." So I was like, "Yeah, Sam, whatever." I knew I was getting on a flight the next morning and it would be done. And then 5 days later, that's when the smear campaign began. And after the smear campaign had been running for 4 or 5 days, the women contacted me, one of whom is one who we both know well. And she had contacted me 18 months before and complained of his abuse to her. And I refused to talk to her because I didn't believe her. I didn't believe her. And she contacted me again and she said, "Do you believe me now?" And I said, "I don't know what to believe." She said, "Can I put you in a WhatsApp group with 6 other women and they'll tell you the same stories?" And I sat there and I was like, okay, there's 2 options here. Either Sam Backman is telling the truth and these women are telling the truth, or this is an elaborate conspiracy to get me to accuse Sam of doing things that he's never done in some broad scale libel case. Which Occam's razor? Which is the simplest explanation? So I chose to believe them. I chose to believe them.
Richard believing the women was a crucial turning point. They now had someone who understood the complicated chaos that Sam creates. He understood the nuances and that none of their stories were straightforward, which causes them to blame themselves and feel shame as though it was their fault. But together, the fog was lifting and there was a clear picture emerging, a predator and prey. In the next episode of The Narcissist Playbook, Richard's panic and request to be dropped from the film.
I am in a documentary praising and essentially recommending a guy who I now know to be a sex predator. You got to pull all that out.
Placing the blame on the victims, Sam's tactic to keep them silent.
The truth is the best defense. Like, he's going to try and convince the people he's involved with that their wrongdoing is greater than his. And he knows perfectly well that that's not true.
And Richard's remorse over promoting Sam to his audience.
I'm very, very sorry. And if anybody got involved with him and was hurt by him because I elevated his status, I unreservedly apologise.
The storyteller Narcissus Playbook is written, produced and edited by me, Isla Traquair, and is the fourth in the Storyteller series. You can see videos, evidence, analysis and more on my Patreon. The link is in the show notes and is a great way for you to show your support for this independent production. Another way to show your support for free is to like, review, share and subscribe. A few clicks makes a huge difference and lets people find this important story. If you've been affected by narcissistic abuse, there are links for support in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening.